When you think of heavy industry, like
Sure.
massive offshore oil rigs or hundreds of miles of steel pipelines sitting at the bottom of the freezing ocean, you usually picture, I don't know, sparks flying in enormous cranes.
Yeah.
Brute force,
Oh,
basically.
totally. You picture hard hats and heavy machinery. You definitely don't picture a group of scientists sitting quietly in a room, trying to write an elegant mathematical equation.
Right. An equation just to predict exactly how the microscopic crystals inside that steel will arrange themselves.
It is a really striking contrast. I mean, we're talking about taking one of the most violent, chaotic, superheated environments imaginable, an electric welding arc, and attempting to find pure, predictable, geometric order within it.
And that is exactly our mission for today. Welcome to this deep dive, especially to you listening on this Sunday, March 15th, 2026. We are exploring a fascinating intersection of theoretical modeling and heavy industrial engineering.
It's a really unique overlap.
Yeah. And to figure out how we solve this, we're looking at a brilliant foundational paper from 1986 by a team of metallurgists, Padesia, Svensson, and Gretoft. It's titled Prediction of the Microstructure of Submerged Arc Line Pipe Welds.
A bit of a mouthful, but a classic in the field.
Definitely. And to help us analyze how these scientists communicated their findings, we're also pulling from a guiding text today called the Measured Principles of Scientific Discourse.
Which is so important here, because what makes this dive so compelling is the sheer ambition of that 1986 experiment. These researchers were trying to tackle a massively complex, really expensive problem using predictive math.
And doing it without, like, bragging, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
As we look at their work through the lens of those measured principles, we get to observe how they reported their findings with absolute objective clarity. They didn't resort to exaggerations, they didn't hide their flaws,
They just followed the math, even when reality threw them a massive curveball.
which it absolutely did.
Well, before we can even look at that mathematical model, though, we really have to understand why we are welding in the first place. Put yourself in the shoes of the offshore industry in the 1980s. Why were they so desperate for this research?
It really comes down to the environment they were moving into. The offshore industry was pushing into deeper, colder, more unforgiving waters, like the North Sea.
Right, which is notoriously brutal.
Oh, incredibly brutal. When you lay a pipeline down there, it is subjected to immense pressure, freezing temperatures, and constant shifting. And the weakest point of any pipeline is the weld, the joint where two massive steel pipes are physically fused together.
And if that joint fails, I mean, you have a catastrophic environmental and financial disaster on your hands.
Exactly. So they desperately needed weld deposits with ever-increasing combinations of toughness and strength. The key to this is the as-deposited, or the primary microstructure of the weld.
But couldn't they just test different welding materials until they found the strongest one? Like, just make a bunch of welds and break them.
Well, that was the traditional way of designing welding consumables. The rods and the flux you used to make the weld, it was essentially trial and error. You'd mix up some chemicals, make a physical weld, break it apart in a lab, and see how strong it was.
Sounds exhausting.
It's incredibly complicated because think about the variables involved. You have the chemical composition of the wire, the composition of the base steel, the voltage, the ambient temperature, the speed of the weld.
Wow, yeah.
Trying every single combination is an insanely expensive and time-consuming process.
Okay, well, let's unpack this. Because instead of, say, baking 100 cakes to see which one doesn't crumble, they're trying to write a mathematical formula that perfectly predicts the cake's crumb structure, right? Just based on the oven temperature and the ingredients.
That's a great way to put it. They wanted to predict the initial microscopic architecture of the metal as it cools from a liquid to a solid.
And to ground you in how they actually tested this, let's look at the physical experiment they set up. They took massive steel plates and carved a deep double-wide groove into the edges where they would meet.
Which naturally causes a lot of base plate dilution, by the way.
Right. And then they ran a mechanized tandem submerged arc welding rig over that groove.
Yeah.
And looking at the specific variables here, this is intense. The bottom bead used a leading electrode at 1,000 amps and 30 volts, moving at 2.36 millimeters a second.
Yeah, and then a trailing electrode ran right behind it at 625 amps and 38 volts. We really need to emphasize the scale of the energy here.
It's basically a lightning bolt.
Essentially, yes. They were pumping enough electricity into these electrodes to power a small neighborhood. You have a localized pool of liquid steel that is intensely bright and violently churning.
Just melting everything.
Melting not just the welding wire, but a considerable amount of the base plate itself,
Yeah.
mixing it all together in this molten soup.
Which brings me to the fundamental pushback I have when looking at this. It feels like you are looking at a raging, chaotic avalanche cascading down a mountain, and you are trying to write an equation to predict the exact crystalline shape of the snowpack at the bottom.
Right.
It's based purely on the air temperature and the original type of snow. I mean, given the thermal violence of a 1,000-amp electrical arc and like 100 degrees Celsius interpass temperature, is it actually possible to predict anything at that microscopic level?
That was the exact skepticism many of their peers had. How can a math equation survive that kind of thermal chaos?
Yeah.
To prove that math could survive, the researchers first had to understand exactly how the heat left the system. You can't predict the microscopic structure if you don't know how fast the metal is freezing.
So how do you measure that in a pool of liquid steel?
They used a very direct technique. They literally harpooned temperature probes' thermocouples directly into the liquid weld pool while it was being deposited.
Wait, really? Shooting probes into a churning pool of liquid steel just to see how fast it cools down?
Yes. They needed to capture the real-time cooling curves. They had to anchor their math to physical reality. And what they found was quite remarkable. The cooling curves for the top portions of their different test welds were virtually identical.
Really? Even with all that chaos?
Yeah, because the massive steel plates surrounding the weld act like a giant heat sink. The heat dissipates into the metal in a very predictable, repeatable way.
Okay, so once you know the exact speed at which the metal is cooling down, you have your baseline.
Right. Once you have that predictable cooling curve, you can introduce what metallurgists call time-temperature transformation diagrams, or TTT curves.
Which are basically maps, right?
Exactly. They map out exactly how much time you have at any given temperature before the atomic structure of the steel begins to transform into different microscopic phases.
Because steel isn't just one uniform, static block of gray metal. At the microscopic level, it's a completely dynamic environment. As it drops from that superheated liquid state down to room temperature, it goes through a whole sequence of events.
A very precise sequence.
So let's zoom all the way in. Let's look at the precise microscopic journey of cooling steel. Once that weld is laid down and starts to solidify, what is the actual battle happening inside?
The paper builds a specific geometric model to visualize this battle for space. When the liquid steel first solidifies, it forms a crystalline structure called austenite.
Okay, austenite.
You can picture these initial austenite grains as a tightly packed microscopic honeycomb. Think of a wall of hexagonal prisms. This honeycomb is the blank canvas.
Got it.
But as the temperature continues to drop, the steel becomes unstable, and a fascinating chain reaction occurs across those honeycomb walls.
It's like a microscopic choreography.
Yeah.
Or a race for real estate.
Man.
And the first tenant to move in is a phase called allotriomorphic ferret.
Yes. Allotriomorphic ferret begins to grow right along the borders of those hexagonal prisms. It relies on a process called atomic diffusion.
Meaning the atoms are literally moving around.
Exactly. At these high temperatures, the iron and carbon atoms still have enough thermal energy to physically migrate and rearrange themselves. So they migrate to the edges of the honeycomb and start building continuous, relatively thick layers that hug the walls.
But the clock is ticking. The metal is cooling incredibly fast because of those giant steel plates sucking the heat away. So what happens when the temperature drops so low that the atoms just don't have the energy to migrate to the borders anymore?
The rules of the game change entirely. Diffusion becomes too difficult, so the system has to find a new way to relieve the stress of cooling. The next phase to appear is Widmansdatten ferret.
Widmansdatten.
Because the atoms can no longer leisurely migrate to the edges, this new phase essentially forces its way into existence. It shoots out from those honeycomb boundaries directly into the center of the grains in the shape of microscopic jagged plates.
Then, as the temperature drops even further, we get the real star of the show, a phase called acicular ferret.
Acicular ferret is fascinating. Instead of starting at the honeycomb walls, it nucleates on tiny, non-metallic inclusions, little specks of dirt and oxygen that are trapped deep inside the grains themselves.
Oh, wow. So it starts from the inside out.
Yes. And it grows autocatalytically.
Meaning it triggers a chain reaction.
Exactly. The flammation of one tiny plate creates stress that immediately encourages the formation of another plate right next to it, pointing in a different direction. It creates a dense, chaotic, interlocking weave of thin plates filling up the inside of the honeycomb.
And finally, whatever tiny slivers of the original blank canvas the austenite are left over, they just abruptly snap into hard, brittle phases called microphases like martensite or retained austenite.
Right, they're too small to define the overall strength, but the math has to account for them.
Now, reading this sequence through the lens of the measured principles of scientific discourse is so refreshing. The authors absolutely refuse to claim this honeycomb model is a perfect reflection of nature.
No, they state very clearly that this is a functional approximation.
Right. They use established equations, like the parabolic thickening rate constant, to mathematically estimate how thick those boundary layers will get before the cooling stops the diffusion.
Mm.
They don't declare that they have perfectly mapped the atomic realm. They openly check their rigorous numerical calculations against simpler approximations just to prove the math is reasonable.
It's totally transparent. What's fascinating here is how they address the inherent messiness of arc welding. For instance, the high cooling rates inevitably lead to solute segregation.
What does that mean in this context, solute segregation?
As the liquid metal freezes, the different chemical elements don't just stay perfectly mixed. The growing solid crystals physically push some of the alloying elements away, meaning the chemical composition ends up being slightly different from one microscopic spot to the next.
Oh, so it's not perfectly uniform.
Not at all. And this segregation actually changes the local temperature at which that first phase, the wall-hugging ferret, begins to form.
Yeah.
The paper calculates all of this purely by trusting their thermodynamic and kinetic formulas, adjusting their curves to account for the segregation, all without ever resorting to hyperbole.
But, you know, a theoretical mathematical model is really only as good as its real-world application.
Yeah.
They can write elegant equations all day long, but they eventually had to test them against reality.
They did.
So they created four specific experimental welds. They kept the core ingredients mostly the same. The carbon, silicon, and manganese were largely similar across the four welds and the base plate, but they introduced an independent variable. They decided to mess with the recipe by adding an element called molybdenum.
Molybdenum is a very common alloying element in heavy industry. It is specifically used to increase the strength of the steel, but introducing it chemically changes how those microscopic phases form.
Weld 1 had just a tiny trace of it, 0.01 weight percent, almost nothing. But welds 2, 3, and 4 stepped up the molybdenum content, peaking at 0.39% in weld 4. Here's where it gets really interesting. They put weld 1 under the microscope, the one basically without the moly. And its microscopic structure matched their theoretical calculations beautifully. The boundary-hugging ferret formed those continuous layers around the hexagonal prisms, just like the equation said it would.
The math worked perfectly for weld 1.
It did. But then they looked at welds 2, 3, and 4, and the molybdenum threw a massive wrench into the gears. The allotriomorphic ferret layers became completely discontinuous.
What exactly did the molybdenum do to break the model? It comes down to the physical size of the atoms. Molybdenum is a relatively large, bulky atom compared to iron.
Okay.
When you add it to the molten mix, it creates what metallurgists call a solute drag effect.
Yeah.
Remember how that first phase of ferret grows by having atoms migrate to the boundaries via diffusion?
Right. They migrate to the honeycomb walls to build a continuous layer.
Well, those bulky molybdenum atoms also gather at the boundaries, and they physically get in the way. They act like boulders in a stream. They restrict the boundary from moving uniformly.
So instead of a smooth, continuous wall of ferrite, you get a broken, patchy, jagged fence.
Precisely. The continuous layer becomes discontinuous. And that completely breaks the geometric assumption of the math.
Oh, because the mathematical model rigidly assumed a perfect unbroken border along the austenite grain boundaries.
Exactly. Because if the wall is completely broken and patchy,
you can't even measure the size of the honeycomb anymore.
You can't. It created a cascading problem for their formulas. Under the microscope, it became incredibly difficult to even identify where the austenite grain boundaries were. And if you can't measure the size of the initial honeycomb, you can't calculate how much volume the subsequent phases are going to take up. The equation just falls apart.
So how did they solve it? If the molybdenum blinded them to the size of the grains in welds 2, 3, and 4, did they just scrap the experiment?
No, they used a mathematical workaround. Because they had successfully measured the grain size in weld 1, which was exactly 96 micrometers, they made a huge assumption.
They just borrowed it.
Yes. They assumed that the 96 micrometer grain size from weld 1 applied to all the other welds just to run the calculations, regardless of the molybdenum content. They essentially borrowed the constant from the one clean weld so they could force the equations to run for the messy welds.
That is a massive leap of faith. You're taking data from a clean environment and pasting it over a chaotic environment just to see what happens. But again, going back to our source on measured discourse, Look at how the scientists report this.
It's brilliant.
They don't try to hide the flaw. They don't bury this borrowed constant in the fine print at the bottom of the page.
No, they plainly, objectively state that because the layers were discontinuous, their theory inherently overestimates the volume fraction of that allotriomorphic ferrite in the molybdenum-containing welds.
They just point directly to the gap in their own math.
Yeah, they write that they acknowledge much more detailed work needed to be done to understand grain boundary nucleation.
It is the pinnacle of scientific honesty. They are completely laying bare the limits of their model. But, you know, despite that disruption, we have to look at whether the model still offered practical value.
Because the ultimate test isn't whether the math is perfectly elegant.
Exactly. The ultimate test is whether the pipe cracks at the bottom of the freezing ocean. Did these varying microstructures actually change how strong the metal was?
That takes us to the mechanical payoff. They ran rigorous mechanical property testing on physical cutouts of these four welds. They did tensile tests, pulling the metal apart to see how much stress it could take before permanently stretching.
And crucially, they did standard Charpy impact tests, which, if you haven't seen one, is fascinating to watch.
It really is.
You basically take a small, thick rectangular bar of the weld metal, cut a specific V-shaped notch into the side of it, and then swing a massive heavy metal pendulum down like a hammer to smash it.
And you measure exactly how much of the pendulum's energy is absorbed by the metal before it snaps in half. The more energy it absorbs, the tougher the steel is.
And they didn't just smash these bars at room temperature. They chilled them down to 20 degrees Celsius, 0 degrees, all the way down to a freezing negative 60 degrees Celsius.
Because toughness at deep sub-zero temperatures is exactly what those offshore pipelines require.
Right. And the data from those pendulum swings reveals a very clear champion,
yeah.
Weld 3, which had about 0.24% molybdenum in its recipe. It emerged with the absolute best toughness across the board.
And its yield stress was also the highest at 612 megapascals.
Wow. And when they compared that physical toughness to the microscopic math, it all clicked into place. Weld 3 had the smallest calculated amount of that boundary-hugging allotriomorphic ferrite, a 0.12 volume fraction, and had the highest amount of that internal chaotic acicular ferrite at 0.76.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this perfectly confirms a critical metallurgical notion that was driving the industry. Acicular ferrite is the highly desired phase for toughness.
Right, because of that autocatalytic chain reaction we talked about earlier, it forms as a dense, chaotic weave of tiny interlocking plates inside the grain. Think about it like trying to chop a block of wood.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
If the grain of the wood is perfectly straight, your axe slides right through and splits it in half. But if you have a block of wood where the grain keeps changing direction every single millimeter, your axe just gets stuck. It takes immense energy to force your way through it.
That is exactly what happens to a microscopic crack trying to travel through a acicular ferrite. The crack tries to propagate, but it gets constantly deflected and stopped by these intersecting plates. It absorbs the energy of the pendulum.
That makes total sense.
And conversely, the experiment confirmed that the allotriomorphic ferrite, the phase that forms first along the boundaries, is actually the weaker phase that restricts the toughness of the weld.
Because it acts like the straight grain of the wood. It creates continuous, relatively easy paths for cracks to travel along the borders of the honeycombs. It's a highway for failure.
Yeah.
So the less of it you have, the tougher the joint.
And here is the ultimate victory for the 1986 team. Even with the calculation errors caused by the discontinuous layers from the molybdenum.
Even with the bulky atoms creating patchy layers and throwing off their geometry.
Exactly. The model correctly predicted the high volume of acicular ferrite because of the high carbon and alloy content. The model proved that the theory was fundamentally useful, even if it was mathematically imperfect.
It proved you didn't need to bake 1,000 cakes, or, to use our earlier analogy, you didn't need to trigger 1,000 avalanches to find the strongest snowpack. You could use thermodynamics to point you toward the optimal recipe.
It really was a massive leap forward for heavy industry.
So what does this all mean? When we step back and look at the whole picture today, we are looking at a paper that successfully proved phase transformations theory can be used to estimate the complex microstructure of submerged arc welds. But more importantly, it is a brilliant testament to the power of measured scientific discourse.
Absolutely.
Progress isn't made by claiming absolute perfection. Progress is made by transparently documenting exactly where your models succeed and exactly where they break down, like with the molybdenum curveball.
There is a profound lesson here for you, the listener. Whether you are managing a complex corporate project, studying a brand new scientific field, or just trying to solve a complicated, messy problem in your life. There is immense value in creating a baseline model, testing it rigorously against reality, and honestly reporting the discontinuous messiness of that reality.
Right. It's the honesty about the model's flaws that allows the next generation of thinkers to build a better one.
Exactly.
That is so true. And it leaves me with one final lingering thought for you to chew on today. Think back to that mathematical workaround the scientists had to use when the molybdenum broke their geometry. To make their equations function for the messy welds, they had to borrow the 96 micrometer grain size from weld one.
And just assume it remained constant across the board.
Right. It begs the question, how many foundational formulas, algorithms, and systems that currently govern our modern world, from global economics to artificial intelligence, are secretly relying on a borrowed constant, simply because the reality on the ground was too discontinuous and messy to measure?
That's a slightly terrifying thought.
Isn't it? And what massive breakthroughs might we discover if we finally figured out how to measure them?